I'm really excited for this, Neil. Thanks for joining me today. For our
Oh, thank
listeners,
you. Yeah,
yeah, of course, man. And if can you give us a bit of an intro for our audience, and then we'll take it from there.
absolutely. Well, my pleasure to be here. I've heard a lot of things about your podcast, and it's a privilege to be able to talk to you, find out more about myself. That's what I love about these sort of interviews, is I get to learn something new about myself, and I walk away thinking, "Huh, I really messed up." But I'm a family doctor who practices in Waterloo, Ontario. I'm originally from Scarborough, and just took this interesting journey about self-discovery along with med school, residency, and finding my place in the health tech world. From med school, I went over to Ireland. My sister went to med school in Ireland, and I was like, all right, that's pretty cool. I don't want a desk job. Funnily enough, I have a desk job now. I don't want a desk job. I want to do something that has impact. And so I was like, yeah, let's go be a doctor. And so I followed my sister over to Ireland, did my med schooling there, got into residency in Newfoundland, where I did the something called the Nunavfam program. So it's 6 months in Nunavut, and the rest of it in the Maritime provinces. Did my residency up there, and then had a decision, had a choice between coming back to town here in Waterloo, going out to Kingston, staying in Iqaluit, or going over St. John's, and chose Waterloo for the tech. And here I am with tech.
Tell me about your journey with tech. How did you get involved with tech, and how do you see tech influencing healthcare in the future?
Sure. Sounds good. So I was a chicken pecker on the keyboard, like not the 10-finger typing. I was very much like two fingers tapping away. And, kudos to my sister again. She saw that and she's like, what's wrong with you? Go do a typing class. But I was a lazy kid. And so I was like, nah, the two fingers work great. I'm typing at 20 words per minute. Why would I ever need to go faster than that? So she convinced my mom, and I was pissed off at that time, but now looking back, it was one of the best things she did. Convinced my mom to send me to a computer course where they teach you how to program, teach you how to become a Microsoft C++ certified a troubleshooter for a computer, and how to build and disassemble computers and fix them. Did that for 3 years, and it was mind-boggling about how much different computers are to us, but yet how similar they are. And one of the basic tenets is, hey, stop and restart a computer. But two, it's also, if the computer goes wrong and you've checked all the parts, the problem isn't the computer, it's you. And it really taught me on user experience and user interface, being like, was the process wrong? I mean, obviously there can be programming issues, but for the most part, is the process wrong? And why am I making a mistake along the way? And that's really changed the scientific methodology of how I think. And so then that led me into the whole world of programming, automation into my, back in like, when I was 12, 13, automating stuff on my computer. I was doing robotic process automation through mouse movements back when I was 14, because I was getting bored of having to convert all my photos over to a different format. And then when I got back from residency, and throughout med school and residency, I was the tech guy continuously. When I got back from residency, it was like, what do I want to do with my life? And I totally saw the innovation, the fast-paced nature, as being the foundation of the future. AI was just starting in or was around for a while, but was just coming into the public sphere again after going through that moment, the 10 years of silence. I forgot what the term is, but 10 years where nobody heard anything about AI, and then it came back up. And I was like, you know what? What's medicine going to be? Do I memorize everything from that textbook from med school? Absolutely not. Computers are just smarter, and they keep getting smarter. And I think we have this tendency of thinking, well, we're at the peak of our civilization, we can't be smart. No. We have a long way to go. And that's actually one of the reasons why I have this image in my background as a Dyson ring, because this is, a Kardashev 2 civilization of the four Kardashev levels there are. We are nowhere near that. We're a Kardashev 0. And so it really, like, science fiction has really showed us that we're still continuously innovating, and technology is going to be a part of that. And so as a physician, where am I going to be? Am I going to be that clinician who says, nope, technology is where it's at. It's not going to get better. And it's all about that human to human interaction. Or is it going to be all technology where it's, hey, we don't need humans anymore? Or is it going to be a hybrid version in between? I think the truth is most likely going to be a hybrid version. And I want to be a part of that journey and help to figure out what that pathway looks like. And so I was like, all right, I want tech. Where do I go for that? My sister, again, was living in Waterloo. And she's like, why don't you come to Waterloo, check out the scene, figure out what you want to do, and consider moving here. She had her other reasons too for wanting me to come to town and stuff like that. So I came here, loved the entire ecosystem. And from there, made myself a couple of business cards that are different from my office business cards. And went out to hackathons and conferences and stuff. And it just took off from there. Oh, and became an advisor for a couple of not-for-profit organizations.
You said something interesting there, that the future of tech and of healthcare in general may incorporate tech to human interactions versus human to human interactions. I think most of us would say that AI now can pass the Turing test, especially on a chatbot. It's very difficult to differentiate if you're talking to a human or not. What are your thoughts on a completely AI guided mental health counselor? Do you think it's a net positive or net negative? And how do you navigate a future where there is no human interaction in healthcare for specific illnesses or disease processes?
It's a great question. Go back and forth on this, and you really hit, there's a few different parts on this one. Let's take the basic and easy one. If I were to have high blood pressure, there are five different classes of medication. Each class of medication has anywhere from 2 to 15 candidates within it, all over the world. And what a typical clinician does is they memorize 1 to 2 drugs per class and rinse and repeat for every patient. And we have an order, right? We hit the ACE ARBs first, then we'll throw in a calcium channel blocker, then we'll throw in a beta blocker, then we'll throw in an alpha. And we just rinse and repeat. But how do we know that right drug is for the right person? And so, for me, a Candesartan may be an okay drug, but Telmisartan would have been way better. But for you, it would have been completely different. We don't know that because we don't do phenotyping, we don't do genotyping. I think that's where the value of a human to AI or human to technology piece comes into play. Can we barcode my genotype and phenotype and do pattern recognitions that go beyond what a human can do, like as a clinician human? And actually do the best evidence-based medicine we can possibly do. So that instead of just rinse, giving Candesartan to every single patient, if that fails, give Telmisartan, we can actually say, hey, you know what, Neil, you need Olmesartan. And Rashad, just avoid that entire class of medication. We're going to jump over to ACE inhibitors and go for Orammitril for X, Y, and Z, because study A showed that patients in this category with your phenotype had these issues. That's not something I can do mentally. That's not something I don't think any human can do mentally. And it's just pattern recognition between. So we're going to get to this point where the common conditions that we know a lot about, we're going to be able to do over and over again. Then that's going to translate over to, well, what about surgeries and the hands-on approach of things? Well, we have anatomical variants in the body. We have different conditions and the way they spread and how they affect it. So a lot more complex. But again, as we learn more and as we start doing video and image to knowledge generators, that's slowly going to start peeling away as well. And I'd even argue that we might even be able to deviate away from most surgeries through newer and newer medication discoveries. Like we've heard about the FDA approving organoids on a chip as an alternative to regular animal trials prior to human trials. We've heard about AlphaFold folding new proteins, and both of us know the newest trend right now is monoclonal antibodies. and all these specific receptor-targeted medications. Let's look at semaglutide. It specifically hits GLP-1 receptors. When we look at tirzepatide, GLP-1s and GIP-1s. And so we're starting to hit receptor level accuracy without causing all the additional side effects. As we start building these proteins and being able to fold them better, virtually, digitally, we can actually start interacting with it. And so now we're starting to say, hey, you know what? Do we really need bariatric surgery? Or can we deviate this and go towards medication? Do we really need to do a rectal cancer excision? Well, that was a study from 2000. Don't quote me on this. I think it's like 2019, 2020. It represents 4% of all rectal cancers with a specific type of mutation, but they showed 100% remission. Phenomenal. Now, when we hit mental health is so weird. Not that conditions are weird, I'm saying it's weird from a tech point of view, because now you could actually feed it your entire email history, calendar, everything, and it can start to learn more about you. Is it better? Is it not? Will people get disturbed by it? Or have we just discovered our forever doctor? You know, the Chat MD is the joke I go by, which is here's a doctor that understands your cultural issues, your personal issues, can age with you, and is a face that you trust. So I'm probably going to say, yeah, you know what? Tech's probably going to be better than what I can do as a human. I think, like any good beard, it's going to be ugly as it grows, but once you get it nice and big, it's nice and bushy, it looks gorgeous.
I have, I think, about 30 questions here. I'll
Amazing.
start with an easier one. If you had a one-way ticket to Mars for yourself and your loved ones to start a healthcare system there, would you go?
Me, yes. Wife, no. She's already said no. I've asked her this question. My first love is not medicine. My first love is actually being an astronaut. Always my journey in life. And if I, you know, when I started dating my wife, I told her that on the, I think the first or the second date, being like, look, this is my passion. If I can go to space, I'm going.
Yeah.
It's still a point of contention between us.
The problem of AI in medicine, of personalized medicine, and some of the things you mentioned, isn't a technical problem at this stage. It's a regulatory problem and a reimbursement problem from my perspective. Who do you think will be liable if this AI makes a mistake? Will there be shared liability between the AI and the patient? And what do you see reimbursement looking like?
Absolutely. And you know what? I think we make mistakes as well. I know I have before. I think from a reimbursement point of view, that's one of the harder ones. I think right now, if an AI makes my life easier, I'm more likely to pay for it at this point. And do I expect somebody to pay for my use of an AI? No, because as a clinician in the public sphere right now, you know, we're not salaried. We're actually more contract based, and so anything that makes me more efficient gives me that advantage. I think if I was salaried and you're trying to improve my efficiency, well, then I don't have to really worry about reimbursement. I'm more worried about just being replaced at that point. When we look at regulatory aspects, yeah, that's probably the only thing that's protecting many clinicians. Now, don't get me wrong, I don't think AI has reached that point of accuracy just yet, that we do see mistakes. I've seen it make mistakes in both prototypes that haven't hit markets yet, as well as, hey, you know what, the ambient AIs I use, it still can't parse through some of the natural language that we use. And so when we look at the regulatory piece, my personal opinion, as a reflection on what's happening around the world, we're most likely going to see the introduction of AI in areas where they don't have clinicians at all. And it's just pure scalability. So if somebody can log on and for 20 cents analyze whether or not they have tuberculosis versus a bacterial pneumonia versus a viral pneumonia, which, by the way, the technology exists, there's plenty of papers that are published on this in Nature. Then, yeah, I'm going to do that rather than having to have somebody listen to my lungs with a stethoscope and get an X-ray and get exposed to radiation. And then, you know what? It's just a VPN away. There's tons of VPNs that are available. And so, if you have somebody who comes to a country where they don't have access to primary care, but you have this cough, you work an hourly job, and you don't have time to take time off to go see a clinician who only works 9 to 5 and can't do it after hours, and you're living paycheck to paycheck, and you know another country has this technology and we put geographic limitations on it because of regulations. Well, what stops me from actually just VPNing into a server in that country, downloading the app, coughing into the cat cough analyzer and saying, you know what, it's viral, I'm good. I don't need to do this anymore. Knowing that that's more sensitive and specific than one of our tests are.
So
And so I
why
think,
aren't we using the technology if it exists?
great question. I don't have an answer for you. I think there's a couple of problems here, right? In Canada, our population is so small. At 30 million people, we're not a big enough market. What we have in value is more so the fact that we are, a developed country with a public healthcare system that will pay for stuff. But we do have regulations around our healthcare products and stuff like that, which is for good. Don't get me wrong. We need those regulations because there are also a lot of technologies out there that don't work that we need to protect ourselves from. And so part of the reason is, what does that process look like? Do we allow for easy entrance for the right companies? We'll make sure we weed out the ones that we don't want, that don't pass the muster. And then, so going back to that example, I could easily VPN into a country and use a bad app that doesn't give me the right analysis, and that puts my health at risk. So I think we protect ourselves a lot more with those regulations. But the question is that balance between, are we actually slowing down innovation and adoption versus are we protecting humans at the same time?
I work in urgent care. I'm sending people for x-rays. I'm doing TB tests all day. It
Mm-hmm.
seems like if a cough detection tuberculosis technology exists, that's an easy yes. But let's table that discussion for a later date.
Agreed.
Do you think we have a soul, or are we millions and millions of synapses interacting in specific patterns?
Okay, so don't get me wrong. I do believe we're synapses that interact in specific patterns, and consciousness is a combination of our entire universe working together, or our entire brain working together with the universe. Whether or not we have a soul is the definition of what is a soul, and that is more of a ethereal idea. I think there's more to the universe than what we perceive in our four dimensions. We know mathematically that there are 11 dimensions to our universe. M theory shows that. String theory shows that. We know we don't interact in these other, X7 dimensions. So we do length, width, height, and time. What about the other seven? And so the question then is if there is or is not a soul, then the question also is there or is there not also living? Does living exist? Does death exist? Does death just mean you move on to another dimension? Are we all just living in a matrix? Am I actually just the byproduct of a dream, and all of you guys are just characters in my other dimension's brain, right? Then there's a theory I was just reading the other day about black holes, and each black hole you pass through is a dimension lower, a dimension lower. So if I were to fall into a black hole, am I going to a two-dimensional space? Am I dead at that point, or am I alive at that point? What are the different other ways? And so I think the idea of a soul and whether or not there's dimensions is a whole different concept. And do I think there's more to the universe than we know? Absolutely. We know that mathematically. Have we discovered it yet? No, and that's what makes it so much exciting, more exciting. But I'm not going to wait around for it. There are people who are suffering and dying right now. My chemical organic brain can make it happen, can do good. The soul is what the soul is. But I'm still gonna just go out and do what I think is right by the people.
You said a word there, which I cannot define, and I'm hoping you can, de define consciousness.
Self-awareness?
Do
You know what? The best quote I've heard of consciousness is the universe itself trying to figure itself out. I think that's what I see consciousness as, is us trying to figure out consciously what the universe is.
Think AI can possess consciousness?
Yes. Yeah.
Interesting.
It's the same reason why I think an octopus has consciousness too. It's not a human specific trait. It's a
Is it a
combination of
living
synapses.
specific trait?
Yeah. Sorry?
Is it a trait specific to a carbon life form, or can a silicone life form possess consciousness?
I think a silicon life form can possess consciousness. And scientifically, same level of the periodic table. We can keep going down that entire level. Does it have to be silicon? Can it be gold? I don't know. It depends on how DNA gets formed and what consciousness really is. Could it be plasma? All it is just synapses working together.
Okay, so in our reality as humans, our rights and laws apply generally to conscious beings or living things. How do you think about the rights of AI as we build these machines or these systems which, quote unquote, possess consciousness and maybe have emotions? How do you think of AI rights?
I think we need to probably tackle that sooner than later. It was really like about 10 years ago, I remember reading an article about India recognizing dolphins as conscious and sentient. Well, really interesting article. It kind of got me thinking. It reflected back on a Star Trek episode about Data, the android, and whether or not it's conscious, alive, and should have its own self-determination and self-will. Essentially, there was a scientist at Starfleet that wanted to disassemble Data. And the argument was, no, you're actually killing a unique life form. A life form that wants to live, discover, has curiosity, and wants to, move forward in life, do something new with its life, make an impact. And the argument was that, yeah, you know what? Data, this android, is alive and has consciousness, and therefore has a right to self-determination and self-will, and is not the owner of any person. And we're about to hit that. Maybe in 5 years, maybe in 10 years, maybe in 20 years, but I think in our lifetime, we're going to hit that. And it's a scary proposition for humans as a species, because for the first time ever, we're starting to see something of almost equal in intelligence, potentially more intelligent than we are, that we created that we've never experienced before. That we haven't experienced aliens. We haven't met another sentient being in living consciousness, living memory. I don't know about our predecessor of the Homo genus, but in living memory, no, we don't have that. And so I think that's what scares people, being like, did we just create our replacement? And so the future is hybridization. That's why I'm a big fan of Neuralink. It is the merger of technology and silicon life with carbon life.
One of the reasons I think AI hasn't seen the adoption in medicine that it has the potential to is because we limit it to things that make sense to us. We say, look at the heart rate variability and see if this patient is sick. But perhaps what they need to look at is the back of their heel. And by that, they can say if the patient is sick. There are things which don't make sense to us that AI will discover. It will look at an X-ray and diagnose diabetes. And we will have no idea how I did that. And we cannot understand. Maybe we're limited by our senses. Maybe it's looking at the seventh dimension. Who knows what it's doing? But it will analyze things in a way which just do not make any sense for us. Now, our colleges have come out with a framework for explainability in AI. And they are saying, you must be able to somewhat hype, and you don't have to exactly explain because AI is a black box by definition, but you must be able to say, okay, if from an X-ray of your first metacarpal joint, it's this AI saying your triglyceride is 8. How do you see about the future here with AI coming up with things like that? And how do you see regulation fitting in there? And do you think we should kind of just see what AI does? And if, AI is seeing we have diabetes based on an X-ray and we do an HbA1c and we have diabetes and we do 20,000 of these and the sensitivity and specificity is 99.9%, then the new test for diabetes is an X-ray and not HbA1c. How do you see that evolving?
Agree with you. It's non-inferiority. The moment we can show that an AI can do it in a non-inferior way to what we have, and potentially even to a superior methodology, it replaces it. And that's what I love about the scientific method. It has nothing to do with the human attachment of this is a human way of doing it. The question is more so, do we have a better way of doing it? If we have a better way of doing it, fantastic. It doesn't matter if I'm hurt that I can't look at an A1C or a cholesterol panel anymore and we're using an X-ray instead. Science is science, and it makes no judgment one way or the other. What I think is really interesting here, though, is something you had said earlier in regards to how do we see the division of AI, and what happens then is if we start protecting ourselves because we're a human-based interaction rather than a computer-based interaction, we're losing. The fact that we have to justify a position because of us being humans is a losing battle. It's always what the best science is, and that's it. All right, so when we look at, like, hey, what does AI see that we don't see? I love that you asked that question because there's a great experiment called the double pendulum experiment. And essentially, what we did was we've, and by we, I mean humans as a species, the scientists fed it all of the known physics laws that we had and asked it to create a formula. And it created almost a very similar formula to what we have to explain a double pendulum. But then what they did was they actually said, all right, cool, we're going to reset the whole thing. And we're actually going to remove all the variables that humans have described. And that they want the AI to predict how many variables would could explain this double pendulum swing. And it described more variables than we know. The problem with the black box, though, is we can't ask it what it found. But what we do know is it found more laws of physics than we could describe. And they repeated the test and they're like, yep, no, it's consistently finding new variables that we can't explain. So it sees something that we don't see. And one of the most common things I've heard from AI skeptics is, well, have you heard that story about when they analyzed wolves versus dogs? And what it did was it looked at the snow behind it and determined that's what caused wolves. That's a 2012 study. We've moved so far past that now that I don't think that's a valid argument unless you're using a really poor model on AI. So I think we are moving towards that piece of AI does see things and know things that we don't. Whether or not it can describe it is a whole different story. But there's papers out now where they actually have AI self-interrogating or interrogating another AI to ask about those black boxes. And so I have a hypothesis that our organic brain is actually just a multitude of different interrogation processes of we hypothesize, we test, we reformulate. And that testing piece gets us to self-criticize our own models and then rinse and repeat, and we refine it over and over again. And we see that in our kids as well, right? When somebody's learning how to walk, they make mistakes, they trip, they fall, then it refines it. Then the child gets better and better, and then it becomes second nature. And then great, then we move on to another skill. And that's what we do with all things in terms of our daily life, what we went through med school, what we learned through writing. Okay, that's not how you write the letter A, B, C. It's not CBA or something like that, but it's that refine, rinse, repeat.
Do you think we should value things more if a human made them?
Ooh. This debate actually is funny that you bring this up. I had this debate with a friend of mine yesterday about what is value and do we need to be afraid of AI disturbing that value? And also, what is money and why do we value money? What I realized at the end was it's all subjective. Value is based off of what we want. There's at one point those non-tangible funds or something that where people are buying and selling art. And at one point, it was considered valuable during the pandemic, and then we realized it was all a waste of money. Value is variable. And whether it's human-based versus non-human-based, I think that's determined by society. So right now, we value the Olympics because it's a drug-free competition of the best athletes in the world. But there is a non, there's a drug, sorry, drug-full hyper-enhancing Olympics as well that exists, and people are starting to catch on to that. All
So
right, yeah.
we're talking about value, and specifically, let's talk about if an AI makes a medical device versus an AI makes a song or a painting.
Yeah, you know what? I don't think a human-based one would be any more valuable. In fact, there's an argument here that some people may say an AI device is better than a human device. More organic, more structural, more whatever, uses an alloy that we haven't discovered yet, or a ceramic we haven't discovered yet. We already see it in advanced material manufacturing. I subscribe to a newsletter that talks about all things AI and material ma science. Oh my God, the stuff that's creating, mind you, all in a laboratory. We haven't hit mass manufacturing, but that's where all this starts. And we're starting to see that as well in our battery technology. We're seeing unique anodes and cathodes using ceramics being produced that are hitting that near manufacturing level. It's going to change the way we run our practice, or sorry, our world. But those are AI designs based on human foundations. Don't get me wrong. And somebody's going to say, well, all the way down it was humans. Yeah, but before humans were other Homo sapiens, and before that there was a whole different species. So all the way down, it actually wasn't even us. All the way down, it was amphibians.
Let's come back to healthcare,
Yeah,
since
sounds good.
we are both physicians in our day job. Talk to me about the future of physicians in healthcare. How do you see AI playing a role, and how do you see private and government innovation playing a role?
In healthcare. So I see AI starting off as, well, you see it right now, taking over the tasks we don't want, writing notes, billing referral letters, all the scut work that annoys us. Where I see it moving towards, and this is where it goes from like a class one to a class two healthcare device, is where it starts making recommendations of, it's not going to start prescribing things, but it starts to say, hey, you know what? Have you considered this medication, this laboratory test? Just takes it to the next level. And I see that as a win from a government point of view. A healthier population is a more engaged population. It also means less cost on the system as a whole. And so I don't see that being the barrier. I think the bigger role that the government plays in all of this is just, how do we let the innovation happen while putting up some guardrails that ensures privacy and security exist? I have a thing on privacy and security. So, for example, I don't believe privacy exists. I think security exists. So, as an example, I want my healthcare team to have my data. Within that team, there might be one person, five people, 100 people. In which case, privacy for me does not matter. What I want is security that only the people who need to see my records are seeing it. It's been brought up in healthcare all the time that just because we close the curtains in an emergency room, that the bed next to that person can't hear the diagnosis, and that's privacy. That's not privacy, right? That's just poor security. What we need to do is augment security. Now, again, personal opinion on all of that. But yeah, we need to tackle security first, and that privacy is a byproduct of that. And so that's where government comes into play. Regulations, let's put some guardrails up so that we don't veer off course. Let's put some recommendations of, how we have a data nutrition label on like food and drinks and stuff like that. Well, why can't we have an AI nutrition label that says, by the way, this was tested on Southeast Asians in the age group of 20 to 40-year-olds and should not be used outside of that group. And what we're doing is we're putting that plain language of what can I as a clinician do, but that data nutrition label is mandated by a government. And so as a result, we had that innovation. We have all those perfect things, but now we know, hey, you know what? This is the wrong AI model to use for detecting skin cancer, because my training data for my type of people, brown skin, South Asian, was not in that test subject group. So therefore, this is not a reliable AI. That's government. I think from a healthcare perspective, it's scalable. You can get it to the masses. You can diagnose a whole bunch of things. Could you imagine if we could suddenly get rid of all tuberculosis, or get rid of all, STDs, sexually transmitted diseases in the community, because we could do an at-home test that can tell us immediately whether or not we have a condition. We would be at a whole different level as a civilization.
If you could go back in time 10 years and give yourself one piece of advice, what would you tell yourself?
Stop listening to your own voice. Slow down. Listen to what others have to say. I think that was the dumbest thing I ever did as a kid. Yeah, it's just, there are smart people around. Don't get me wrong, there are people who think they're smart. And that took me time to realize that just because you are old or have a position or something like that, that you automatically are smart. That's not true. But there are smart people around. And so one, age makes no difference. You can have a smart 12-year-old, you should probably listen to them. You also have a smart 90-year-old, you should probably listen to them as well. But equally so, just like how there are, good clinicians, bad clinicians, good something, bad something else. Listen first, then speak. Don't try and jump into a conversation. That was a big lesson I learned about 8 years ago. Actually, part of the personal development was living in Nunavut and interacting with people who aren't scientific, who aren't in it for the glory. They're there to simply live and be human and enjoy life. And that was one of the best moments of my life, was living in Nunavut. There's something beautiful about, the satellite being the wrong position relative to the sun, and therefore the entire city's internet gets cut out for 2 hours, right? And your cell phone signal being so poor that when you ask somebody, hey, pass me your number, we can, hang out later on, they're like, no, I'll just see you at Wingnight Wednesday. And everyone was at the same pub at the same time. There's something beautiful about the social interactions and just talking to somebody. And there's no hierarchy. There's no, hey, you're a lawyer, so you're scary, or hey, you're a venture capital lead, and therefore you must be super smart and scary. No, we're all equal. We all are really, really good at what we do, and we're all really, really bad at what we don't know what to do. And the beauty of language and learning is that we should just I listen to one another. So yeah. So if I could go back, I'd probably say, shut up and listen, because you're pretty dumb.
That's well said. Thank you, Neil. And this has been great to have you on the podcast, and thanks for coming on.
No, it's my pleasure. Thanks for